Hello and welcome to Dialect. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast. We started back in 2002. The website dialectradio.co.uk. We're also broadcast on Bristol Community FM, that's BCFM 93.2. Tony Gosling, and joining me in the studio straight away, let's get stuck in, is George Kosouros. Have I pronounced that right, George?
You have.
Fantastic.
Absolutely.
And you are the Community Development Officer at South Gloucestershire, but you're looking specifically at tomorrow's, well, this is for those of you not listening on the podcast, listening on FM on Friday, Saturday the 29th of June. Tell us about this Armed Forces Day.
Okay, Tony, well, first let me just say that I'm Community Enterprise Officer, so that's the first thing. But Armed Forces Day is a national event which started about 2009. It used to be called Veterans Day, and it was thought that it was more than veterans that should be encompassed. It was thought that the serving personnel at the time, and to encourage community to get more involved. So it was changed to Armed Forces Day, which encompasses the whole lot. We've been running an Armed Forces Day in South Gloucestershire now since 2009, and it's grown steadily over the years. And on Saturday the 29th, this Saturday coming, is the 2013 Armed Forces Day. And for us in South Gloucestershire, this is a very, very special occasion, because not only have we got Armed Forces Day, but we're using this occasion to sign the MOD Community Covenant, so that it brings the community of South Gloucestershire, the communities of South Gloucestershire, I should say, closer and working closer and supporting the communities of our serving personnel. And we have a number of serving personnel living in South Gloucestershire, and it is good to actually incorporate that support between the two communities.
Now, the main event is, I understand, a march of some kind. This is up in Staple Hill. What's happening there?
Right. Well, the day actually starts off in Page Park, and we're going to have loads of things setting up, and the park will be open from 10:30 for people to attend. But for those who want to participate in the parade and see the parade will muster outside the Royal British Legion in Page Road on 11 o'clock, roughly, and then it will march off at 25 past 11. It will go down High Street, Broad Street, and into the park, where we will then hold a drumhead ceremony. Now, the parade is normally about 150 to 200 people. We're expecting a few more this time, but it's going to be interesting with three bands.
Well, tell us about this drumhead ceremony. It sounds like it's going to be loud.
It's it's misleading, actually. It's a form of having a service, if you like, but it was what they used to do in the field of battle when they weren't anywhere near a church. So the local padre of the troop would actually hold a ceremony, and the way they would do it, they would build an altar from the drums, and they would use the standards laid upon those drums, and then the padre would give his sermon. And that is a historic thing that's happened throughout the years, and it's something that follows on an Armed Forces Day, because it actually is something that points to the front line.
Now, there's obvious importance of having church services to do with armed forces, but I mean, it's a little bit uncomfortable too, isn't it, for some people? They feel, you know, should you really be blessing troops as they're going out to kill people? Is there,
wow,
how does it sit together? Because I can remember, for example, watching that old film, Oh What a Lovely War, where there was almost a mickey taking amongst the soldiers of the fact that they were being blessed to go off to battle. So how does that sit together?
Well, I think when people go to war, they go to war because they feel they're on the side of the right. And also most armies and forces, Air Force, Navy, they're there to defend their country. So they feel they have a right, they feel they're in the right, and therefore they feel that they have God's blessing. The fact that the other side may feel the same is not really relevant. It is what they feel.
How does that square with things like Iraq and Afghanistan? Because it's certainly not clear, is it, that going to Iraq, which, I mean, some people say was even an illegal war under international law, doesn't really square with defending Britain. If you compare it with, say the war in Europe in the 1940s, I mean, clearly there were tanks advancing towards Britain, but there doesn't seem to be the case with Afghanistan. I mean, a lot of people say that's more to do with, you know, growing poppies and things like that than that sort of war. So it's a bit of an awkward one, but see if you can go with that.
Well, all I can say is that's something that the political minds of the world, not only the UK, deal with. And it's not something we look at when we look at Armed Forces Day. With Armed Forces Day, what we look at is our serving personnel, the people that have put themselves forward to defend our shores. They may take orders, they may go elsewhere, but that's what they're there for, is to defend our shores. And the people that put themselves on the line for us, I think we should honour them.
Certainly, also, the British Legion is an amazing institution right across the country, and a lot of veterans from all the forces meet at those places. How does that fit, though, with the Help for Heroes? Because will they be involved as well, or is it just the Royal British Legion, the poppy people?
Well, the Royal British Legion have been helping, and they have for many years in Kingswood and Staple Hill and Stoke Gifford, joined with us and supported us in pulling the Armed Forces Day together. But we always have at each Armed Forces Day collections for Help for Heroes. In fact, we've got three organisations that will be on site doing different things, engaging young people, engaging people in different ways to collect money for Help for Heroes. So there isn't a conflict there, and I know people think there should be, or that people think there is, but there isn't. We seem to be working in harmony, but that's one of the things we do in South Gloss. We bring people together and we work in harmony. We put our differences to one side and we get on with what needs to be done.
So who's involved then? Are there cadets involved? Are there serving territorial soldiers? Are there people in active units, full-time soldiers? Are there veterans? Who's going to be there?
Well, I think you've mentioned a lot, actually. We've got veterans, we've got air cadets, army cadets, we've got scouts, we've got veterans from all areas, male and female, marching. We've got the three bands that'll be playing there, and the Salvation Army are involved. So I think you've actually covered everybody. In fact, you stole my thunder because you mentioned all the people that we would have.
Okay, what about for the youngsters? What do they get out of this? You know, say, for example, 14, 15, 16-year-olds. What ages are they taken into the various cadets for the forces?
Well, as cadets, they could join the cadets without any trouble at all. In fact, they'd be very, very welcome, I'm sure. They'd need to be a bit older before they went into the forces. But it's a stepping stone. It gets you involved and you can move forward.
But for many parents, they'll be thinking, well, is this a good thing for my youngster? What do the young people get out of the cadets?
They learn discipline, they learn different tasks, they learn, may sound simple, but they do learn to manage their time and what they do. And it is an important thing to be able to manage your own time.
Well, there's a lot of youngsters that find that a bit difficult. There's a lot of older of us that find that quite awkward.
Absolutely.
The other thing is the British Legion and the Poppy Day. To what extent are they actually involved in organising this rather than just participating?
When we hold it alternately between Kingswood and Staple Hill, and we meet in the Kingswood British Legion building, or we meet in the Staple Hill British Legion building. And they are at all our meetings. They help. They actually involve getting the standards in. They may manage to get a lot of they help with getting flypasts. They just do get involved.
I suppose they've got the contacts, haven't they? They'll phone up the squadron and say, get your planes over here now.
Well, we hope they do.
Now,
always work.
Is there going to be anything like that this time?
No, we haven't got a
flypast. Because that's a bit awkward, isn't
it?
I mean, it's amazing to actually get, if you can actually get that. It must be quite difficult.
Well, we have in the past, but we're not having a flypast this year. And we're not having a helicopter either.
Now, George, you said you're a community enterprise officer. Sorry, I got it wrong at the beginning. But what has community enterprise got to do with organising something like this?
Well, it's an event which brings people together. So it is a community enterprise, and I'm a one-man band. I can't do it all, so I involve a large number of the community in the organisation and management of the project.
Okay. And what are the other things you're doing the rest of the year?
Well, that's another kettle of fish. I wear a number of different hats in the authority, as many of us do. But this is the events side of things that we're discussing now. I mean, I do get involved with tourism as well. But the events side of things is the bit we're talking about. I mean, we had a couple of weeks ago, we had National Family Week, where we had a family fun day in Kingswood. 8,000 people turned up. It was absolutely fantastic. This time we've got Armed Forces Day. And as I say, we've got the parade marching down Broad Street, High Street, into the Page Park. But once it's in Page Park, we've got the drumhead ceremony. But then we've also got live performances. We've got activities for young people. There's face painting, there's bouncy castles, there's bouncy slides, there's games. It's going to be a real good, fun family day out.
Now, you said you've got three bands. What time would be a good time if people want to come and hear that?
Well, the three bands will be in the parade. So,
but will they be playing in the park afterwards or what?
The Salvation Army will be. But the others won't. We've also got in the park two solo artists, female solo artists. One of them is very, very good with 1940s songs to actually take people's memories back.
Now, is the idea partly as this is a bit of a recruitment exercise as well for the forces?
There is going to be a recruitment stand there by the forces, yes. The Army, I believe, are having a recruitment stand. And I'm not sure, I think, but the Navy may also. But so, yes, there will be recruitment as well involved. People will get to know what would be expected of them, which is good.
Now, I know you've also got another event going on over in Yate, a chap called Jake Wood.
Yes, that's right. Jake Wood's giving a talk on a book that he wrote.
It's called Among You, The Extraordinary True Story of a Soldier Broken by War. So this certainly isn't all about spin and about how wonderful it is to join the forces.
Oh, far from it. It's a book... straight from the heart, from what I understand. It's about Jake Wood. It's his own experiences from what I've been given to understand. So it's going to be a very interesting talk, and that's going to be at 3 o'clock in Yate Library.
That's lovely. Well, anyway, George Kasouris, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you for sparing the time.
And also just to remind the listeners, this is all happening tomorrow. That's Saturday, the 29th of June, mostly up at Page Park.
Yes, and the park will be open to the public from 10:30, and it will run through till 4 o'clock with loads of activities for everybody to do for all ages, from 8 to 80. And the parade will muster at 11 o'clock outside the Royal British Legion in Staple Hill and parade along Broad Street, High Street, into Page Park, where we will be holding a drumhead ceremony. And this year we will be having a signing of the covenant between the MOD and South Gloucestershire, the community covenant. And we have three officers, one from the land, one from sea and one from air, and the assistant chief executive of South Gloucestershire Council and the chair of South Gloucestershire Council to sign the covenant. So it's going to be a really interesting, fun day.
Well, and plenty of serving servicemen and women.
Absolutely.
If you want to ask them any questions about what it's really like out there, come along to Page Park on Saturday. George, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tony. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Your voice, your choice. And now I'm joined by Anissa Mirra. Hi, Anissa, and welcome to Dialect.
Hello.
Now, Anissa, you are quite brave, aren't you? Because you've decided to embark on a course in journalism.
Yeah, that's right.
Why did you do that? What made you decide to go and learn about how to be a journalist?
I love reading and writing. It's one of my favourite things I'd like to do. I practically have like a library at home because I just read loads of books. So I thought, why not challenge my writing and reading and go into journalism?
Okay, so what got you into books in the first place? You're one of these bookworms that always got your nose in a book.
Yeah, I was growing up. Practically, you go through like the key stages when you're younger, and I just kept on reading. Like, I just loved it so much.
Okay, any of your favourite authors can you tell us about?
Stephanie Meyer, The Twilight Saga, is really good, but I also like Jacqueline Wilson.
Tell us about Stephanie, first of all.
I picked up one of her books, well, Twilight, the very first one, and read it, and then I watched the film, and I thought, this is actually quite good. And instead of waiting for the other films to come out, I thought, carry on reading the series.
So tell us, for people that don't know about the book, what's the rough idea, what's the story?
It's basically like a romance. The vampire... Edward falls for Bella, who's a human, and basically it's their struggle being together and fighting for their love with everyone else sort of butting in, sort of like a typical relationship, but
Is there any kind of sinking in of teeth and that kind of thing? Vampires, not the sort of thing that you'd probably want to spend too much time with.
No, but this version is very romanticised. There is a bit of fighting and stuff, especially when they bring werewolves in. So,
crikey. Sounds like a bit of PR for vampires. But anyway, what about the other author that you really liked?
Jacqueline Wilson. She does a lot of children's books. So obviously, I was reading hers when I was growing up. And she was at, well, my university, about a year ago, she was at doing a signing with Waterstones.
So can you tell us about some of her more famous titles?
There's the Tracy Beaker series. Gosh, I can't remember the majority of them. There's...
I'm wondering, you know, I've got a thing in the back of my mind that says that she was one of the people involved in this Demon Headmaster years ago, which was made into a television series, for a so-called children's TV series. It was one of the most scariest things I've ever seen. I'm
yeah,
not sure if that
I
was her.
I'm scared of it.
The Demon Headmaster. You ever seen that?
Yeah. I think I watched it. I got nightmares, so I literally like...
Oh, my goodness.
But I'd always go back to watch it because it was so... good, and they used to live on cliffhangers.
It's absolutely brilliant. And and you know, the idea that you've got this kind of headmaster in charge of the entire school of children who's actually hypnotizing them, there's actually maybe a little element of truth to that when you think of some of the you know, the power that the schools have actually over youngsters. Is pretty incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, I think they're they've got a lot of authority now. I mean, a lot of places are much more stricter, but just, I guess it benefits the kids because obviously they're now being put into a structure where obviously they're being taught the rights and wrongs. I mean, in my school, when I was at school, we had signs going up saying left and right, where you had to walk along the corridor if you're going along the left, and to the right, so no one would ever bump into each other.
Well, also, how have you found, because you're studying journalism in Worcester, how have you found, first of all, you know, not living at home?
That was tough, being because I can't cook. And I'm very grounded with my family, so being pushed away and not knowing anything was tough, but I mean, the journey's been crazy, but it's been pretty good.
Okay, and what about the courses, the course itself? Is that how you expected it? What's it been like?
It's been a lot better, actually. I've been learning about the law and ethics of journalism, which I didn't actually think of before I went into the course. I basically was more focused on the writing aspect, but knowing everything behind it, I think it's been a challenge but really good for me.
Well, it might be good for people at the News of the World, or what used to be the News of the World, to do that course about ethics, because they were basically running a criminal gang from their newsroom, and then they had to shut the newspaper down in massive embarrassment over phone hacking. What are your thoughts about that, and have you been studying the phone hacking scandal at all at college?
Yeah, we have, and we did a lot on the Leveson inquiry, and it was just shocking, I think, the fact that so many people were in with it and like no one knew about it. And obviously it's people's privacy that they were hacking into. I think it was terrible. I completely disagree with it. And for me, journalism, I love the fact that you're reporting the truth, but I think it obviously goes to a certain extent.
Now, there are all sorts of different types of journalism. Is there anything you've got your sights set on? There's magazines, there's books even. No, maybe writing books like Jacqueline, or TV, radio. Anything particularly you find most attractive?
At the moment, I've done a bit of all of those. So I've sort of went into journalism not having an idea of what I want to specifically do, but just to sort of go through it all. But I'm enjoying a lot of the magazine stuff because for my last project, I did a magazine with the group. That was really interesting, and I obviously got to go out and interview people. But then I've also done radio as well, and I've enjoyed that so much.
Well, I've enjoyed talking to you as well, Anissa, and hopefully we're happy having some little chats in future weeks.
Hopefully.
See if you've got any interesting stories for us over the next few weeks, and we'll certainly give you a bit of airtime here.
I will. Thank you so much.
Lovely, Anissa. Mira, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Now, earlier this month, right at the beginning of June, was a very special occasion. The NATO elite political gang, that's what I would call them anyway, this is something called the Bilderberg Group, got quite a lot of publicity. They don't really like having publicity. This is a group of royalty, the biggest top bankers in the entire continent of Europe and the United States in the NATO zone. Military, we had BAE Systems, Sherrod Cowper-Coles from the ex-MI6 guy who now works for BAE Systems. He was there. They also had EADS, E-A-D-S, one of the biggest military companies in the whole of Europe there. In with David Cameron, George Osborne, Ed Balls, Peter Mandelson and Kenneth Clark, amongst others. I think Shirley Williams was there too. But anyway, this is a very secretive organisation. They're quite open about the fact that they're actually there. They are nowadays. 10 years ago, they weren't. But they will tell you absolutely nothing about what's being discussed in behind closed doors. It took place in Watford. And for the first time ever, there was something called the Bilderberg Fringe Festival, organised by something called Passing Clouds, which is a London Dalston nightclub. Really quite an amazing event, and kept a mile away from the actual conference itself at the Grove Hotel near the M25 near Watford. 120 most powerful people in the NATO countries were up in that hotel. Meanwhile, on a field, there was an American talk show host called Alex Jones there. Now, quite a controversial chap, but let's have a listen to what he had to say, because though the Bilderbergers themselves won't want any information about themselves, about what's going on inside the conference going out to the public, it was a very, very different story on the opposite side of the hill, a mile away.
I want to salute every single man, woman, and child that have traveled here from all over jolly old England and the rest of the world. I salute you! This is so historic what is happening right now, and I want to start getting into that here in just a moment. I actually had the BBC of like six interviews I've done with them. One of the ladies said, so you say there's a meeting going on here. So you claim there's something called the Bilderberg Group. Are you insane? That's how stupid they think their viewers are. But the truth is, they're losing all their viewers because people are awake to the globalists and their lying propaganda organs. They're arrogant. They are so used to a population that will buy anything they're told that they are destroying their own credibility more and more. There is no doubt that trillions of dollars a month worldwide are stolen from the people of the West to finance the globalist takeover of the planet. And what's so dangerous about it is the globalists have all written books, all made statements about what their plan is for the New World Order. Their plan is worldwide poverty and forced population reduction. They want to bankrupt every family in the world except for a few dozen families so they can control you with their fiat currency and bring in total technocratic world slavery. And the reason there are so many people here today and millions watching in the real free press across the world is because humanity has figured out that we're in deep trouble and that these dangerous parasites have ill will towards us. It's not that they don't care about us. They care about killing us. They want the world for themselves. They've stolen the governments. They've stolen the money. They've stolen the cultures. They've stolen almost everything. And now they want us out of the way so they can move forward into the future with all the technology that humankind developed. They take the ideas and the energy of you, the creative, and they use it against you. And I'm here to tell you how to stop them. Fight them with information, fight them with truth, fight them with art, and never give up and realize that we are. And realize that we are in a war, that they are attacking us, that they are attacking our families, that they are attacking our nations, that they are attacking our cultures. They want us absolutely neutralized so they can take over this planet, and I'm going to break that down today. But first off, I want to say this. The globalists absolutely are angry today to know the shadow government and the periscope of their subterranean world tyranny that has popped up just a few hundred yards away from us, the Bilderberg Group. They have fought for 60 years to maintain their secrecy, and they have threatened their reporters and their media institutions all over the world that they would be fired if they ever even wrote the words Bilderberg. And now all of us together and the real media have forced this out in the open. And I'm here to tell you, without a shadow of a doubt, today is the true beginning of the fall of the Bilderberg Group.
Well, that's Alex Jones there. He's you can find him online at Infowars.com. And actually, what he's saying there is completely true. H. Gordon Tether was a columnist on the Financial Times, and he wrote about the Bilderberg Group back in the 1980s in his Lombard column, which was one of the most famous long-running columns in the Financial Times, the old pink paper. And he insisted on writing about it. And he had some of his columns pulled by the editor of the Financial Times. And eventually he was sacked because he refused to write a column where he couldn't write what he wanted about the Bilderbergers too. So that's going back a little while. So you'll find Alex Jones online at Infowars.com. You'll also find the full version of that speech on YouTube. If you look for Alex Jones and Bilderberg Fringe Festival online, you'll find quite a lot more. And we're having some more of the speeches from the Fringe Festival at the Bilderberg Conference in future programmes.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
And now I'm joined by Paul Fernie. Paul, this week we're looking at Uranus or Uranus.
Indeed we are, Tony, yes. Uranus or Uranus, depending on your preferred pronunciation.
For those of you just joining us, we are on a travel through the galaxy. No, actually the solar system. We started with Mercury and we're heading out. We've just had Jupiter's moons last week. Now, this particular planet, Uranus, where what sort of vital statistics? How far from the sun and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, Uranus is the seventh planet from the sun, and it is the distance from the sun is quite phenomenal. Actually, it's 1,783,000,000 miles from the sun. It's twice the distance again as Saturn is from the sun.
Crikey! So, oh right, so it's twice as far as Saturn. So there's a big gap between. You got all these planets in a fairly short space up till Saturn, and then there's a big leap. Any idea why that is?
No, it's just the way the solar system formed.
Coincidence.
Coincidence.
So is it colder? I suppose it must be out there.
It is. Yeah, Uranus is the coldest planet in the solar system. It has a surface temperature at the cloud tops of -224°C. Uranus also is the only planet that radiates less heat out than it receives. Most planets in the solar system radiate out infrared heat of some description that's visible with the right equipment. Uranus doesn't, and scientists sort of are a bit of a loss why this is. It's primarily made up of methane, hydrogen, much like Saturn is. It's quite an oddball planet, in all fairness. One of its other sort of tricks is the fact that whereas all the other planets and moons in the solar system rotate around the sun like a spinning top spins, so on their axis sort of right side up, Uranus is actually on its side, so it rolls around like a ball would roll around. So what actually happens is, this, for example, the south pole of Uranus faces the Earth. We always see the south pole. We never get to see the north pole because it's facing out from us.
Well, that's a bit strange. So it's not spinning on what would be, I suppose, ordinarily the coldest parts. So the coldest part is, this is very peculiar. It's almost as if you imagine this, the Earth would be tilted on its axis slightly. And at some points, it would be very, very, I don't know, quite, what would happen? You wouldn't have normal seasons, would you?
No, you wouldn't, no. For example, the sort of time it takes to rotate about its axis is 17 hours. However,
so that's a day, basically.
Yeah,
it takes
17 hours
that's
for it
not,
to rotate.
That's not madly different to Earth.
However, if you stood on the pole and watched the sunrise, it would take 42 years before the sun set again. Because that's just the way.
Yes, you might see it once in your lifetime.
Yeah,
great.
Basically, you might have either one long day or one long night, depending on how lucky you are.
Yes. Not the kind of place to gamble your entire life on whether it's going to be daytime or nighttime for most of your life.
Yeah.
Okay, so what about other statistics?
Okay, so it's the time it takes to orbit the sun is 84 years.
Oh, right. Okay, so although the day is pretty much normal for Earth, if you're at the right part of Uranus,
yeah.
The year is 84. So, okay, so you'd be dead before the end of the year. That's
practically,
the idea.
Yeah. Oh, no. Basically, yeah. It's about a human lifetime to orbit once around the sun.
It's not surprising we don't really live on these planets, is it?
It's
is it?
Not, no. No. They're not ideal first homes, really.
You can't breathe the air, and also it's all rather unpractical. The days are so, the years are so slow, you're probably only going to see one of them.
Absolutely.
All right.
It also. The other interesting thing about Uranus was it was actually the first planet to be discovered, in the sense that all the other planets were known because we could see them with our naked eye. It wasn't until the development of scientific telescopes and such that Uranus was discovered. It was first recorded in 1690 by John Flamsteed. However, he thought it was a star. It was only in 1781 that the British astronomer Sir William Herschel actually recorded it as a planet. The other thing as well is, whereas in the solar system most of the moons are named after characters in Greek and Roman mythology, Uranus, majority of Uranus's 27 moons are named after Shakespearean characters.
Now look, just going back to the first guy that discovered it, you shouldn't really have thought it was a star, because it doesn't move around the night sky like a star, does it? I mean, why was he...
Well, the thing is...
How did he make that silly mistake? I mean, if you are an astronomer, you are to a certain extent, Paul, you know, you look gazing up at the skyward. The planets don't move at all in the same way as the stars do. The stars are basically static. The planets wander around. That's where this whole idea of the wandering star comes from.
This is true, but what you've got to bear in mind is 84 years to do an orbit, it doesn't move amongst the background stars very quickly. So, and back in 1690, this guy's life expectancy probably wasn't quite the length of time it takes Uranus to do an orbit. So he may have observed it over a few months, and it probably didn't appear to move very much. So like I say, it wasn't until Sir William Herschel came along in 1781 and actually recorded it consistently for a period of time that it was discovered it was a planet.
Now let's go back again. You know, we're rewinding several times here, but go back to this idea of it being on its side. Now, what does that do to the actual surface and the weather? Because to me, this is extremely confusing. If you've got your planet swinging between spring and summer, and then back to spring again, all in the space of a few hours, you know, that's a little bit weird. And so, how do the seasons work on somewhere like Uranus?
I think what I need to explain is the Earth tilts at an angle to the vertical. It's tilted by 23.5 degrees. So its axis is 23.5 degrees from the vertical. With Uranus, the axis is 99 degrees from the vertical. So it's basically, it's right over on its side. So it's rolling along. It's not... So basically, it doesn't as such have seasons, because... Obviously, one of the poles is constantly facing the sun for 42 years. So weather, with regard to weather and stuff, there is weather patterns on Uranus. However, you need really sort of scientific style telescopes to be able to see the clouds and all that sort of thing. And again, some of the issues around what it would actually be like on Uranus, it's hard to say, really. Purely because we've only visited it once. There's no plans to visit it again. So we're pretty much stuck with the information we got from Voyager 2 back in 1986. So, you know, it's not a hugely studied, because it looks quite boring, really. It looks very blue from through a telescope. It's just like a blue blob.
So we visited it 30 years ago, at least Voyager 2 did, and there's been not a lot of real amazing interest in it since.
Not at all.
Doesn't sound like the most enthralling planet.
No, I mean, it's obviously, you know, it's right out there. It costs a lot of money to send something up there. And there isn't, it's not like, you know, the moons of Saturn and Jupiter, which are very active and all this sort of thing. So I've got a lot of interest, you know. The moons, I mean, the interesting thing as well is if you could actually see the moons orbiting around Uranus, instead of sort of appearing and then going behind the planet, they would go around as though it was like a big wheel. You'd see the moon as it floated around, because obviously it's going over the top of it, not round the back of it.
But isn't that all just depending on which way you look? If you tilt your head sideways, it's just the same.
No, Tony. No, because like I say, because of this strange sort of the fact that, I mean, astronomers believe that what happened was back in the early solar system, a very large body hit Uranus and knocked it onto its side, basically.
Maybe knocked it half out of the solar system too, because it's
possibly quite a long way out, isn't it? Yeah, given a good nudge, I would imagine. Like I say, you know, it's got 27 moons, most of which are named after Shakespearean characters. There's a couple that aren't, and that's
so. Why this interest in Shakespearean? Is it because it was discovered not long afterwards?
Yeah, it was all to do with the time it was discovered. I mean, originally they were going to call it George's Star after King George III, but astronomers sort of went with Uranus and stuck with it.
Well, it ain't a star, so we can't call it that.
Yeah, well, this is it. So. You know, for example, the Shakespearean ones are Cordelia, Ophelia, Bianca and Cressida. However, two of the moons, Ariel and Umbriel, are named after characters in a book called The Rape of the Lock by Alexander Pope.
Well, OK, what about these moons? Are they similar to our own moon?
No, most of them are very small. The largest ones are roughly half the size of our moon.
OK, so not little asteroids or whatever?
No, they're not little asteroids. They're quite substantial, but they're not big in... You know, when we look at... You know, a few weeks ago we looked at like Jupiter's moons and Saturn's moons. They're quite large bodies, whereas these are more small, sort of orbiting, possibly captured from other planets or wanderers that are being captured, along with a few that were probably there from the start. Uranus also has rings, and the rings rotate in the same way that the planet does. So if you looked at Uranus through a powerful enough telescope, you would see the blue of the blue of the planet, and then it would be surrounded by the circles of the rings. So you'd always see the rings sort of around it, almost like one of them balls which you hop on, if you get me drift.
Okay. What about this Voyager 2? Did it actually go and land on the surface of it? What's the surface like?
The surface, it's believed that it's got a rocky surface or possibly even an ocean.
So I take it that Voyager 2 didn't actually land.
No, Voyager 2 is Voyager 2.
It sounds like the planet that NASA has kind of avoided slightly. It's a bit like it sent something past it, but it didn't actually want to stay around.
It's a bit like our next visit, which is Neptune. It sort of skipped through and had a quick look. I mean, Voyager 2 is still going. It's now on the very outskirts of the solar system, but it took some pictures. You know, talking distances. I mean, if you wanted to travel from Earth to Uranus, you would need to travel somewhere in the region about 1.5 billion kilometres from Earth to
That's going to take a while, isn't it?
That's going to take a long time. I mean, I think it took Voyager. Voyager was launched in like 1978, Voyager 2, I think. So it took that 8 years to get there.
Right.
So it's a good distance out. I mean, this is a long way off. I mean, you can see Uranus with the naked eye. It's just about on human visibility, which is at magnitude -5.6.
All right, so you can actually just about see it with the naked eye.
But you'd need to go to somewhere very dark, maybe out onto the moors or somewhere like that, and you'd need to know where you were looking to find it. You can see it quite easily with binoculars in sort of in a city environment.
And now you say it's a little bit like a star. It's more or less in the same place in the sky. Is it visible at the moment?
It will be visible at the moment. I can't remember off the top of my head which constellation it's in at the moment.
Okay, so it will be slowly wandering from one constellation over the years.
Yeah, over the years it moves, like all the planets do, obviously at different speeds. They move through the constellations, the zodiacal constellations through the years, you can view Uranus if you've got the equipment and the knowledge of its whereabouts.
Well, my big disappointment with Uranus is we don't know if it's rocks or an ocean on the surface. Come on, Paul, what's your guess?
Oh, I imagine it's a mix of them both, if it's anything like Earth.
If a big question, is it?
Oh, well, that's the big question, isn't it?
I think NASA...
I think we should lobby NASA to send up a new probe.
NASA have messed up here. Yeah. If we can't actually figure out if it's a giant sea or a bunch of rocks, then we could probably
with a bit more research.
They should get the Voyager 2 money back.
Yeah,
at least part of it.
You know, I think sort of Uranus and Neptune are sort of the forgotten few of the solar system now, and are sort of left to get on with their own devices.
Okay, well, I hope it's going to be looking out for Neptune. We know a little bit more about the surface of that next
week.
Yeah,
I don't think they know much more about that one, but I'll try and find out as much as I can.
Okay, Paul Fernie, thanks very much for joining us again on our We're getting near towards the end
of our... We're nearly at the end now.
So what is that? Is it just Neptune?
It's
or have
Neptune,
we got Pluto as well?
Pluto's not a planet. It's not allowed anymore. I'll probably cover sort of these dwarf bodies as a whole in a couple of weeks. But we'll do Neptune next week, and then we'll have a look on the outskirts of the solar system.
Okay, Paul Fernie, thanks very much again for joining us on Dialect.
Thanks, Tony.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Now, we heard earlier on from Alex Jones, Infowars.com, at the Bilderberg Fringe Festival. But now let's have a listen to some of the UK's more mainstream media coverage, and you'll hear an interview with me. But before that, Charlie Skelton. He's a comedy writer for Jimmy Carr.
Charlie Skelton is a comedy writer who's reporting for The Guardian on the secretive comings and goings at the annual conference. I spoke to him earlier and I asked him how would he describe the Bilderberg conference?
A thing which happens once a year, which is a giant security operation, which Watford is just finding out, and a large international policy summit. And obviously, they're very secretive, so what you can find out is a little bit limited. But this year, there is a little bit more dialogue between the press and the Bilderberg group, so that's good.
So we've got a load of rich boys in a room together, having a few pints of lager, and they're trying to change the world. Effectively, that's what they're doing then.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what they're drinking. I don't know if it's lager. It's probably more expensive than that.
Yes, yes.
And it's not just rich boys. I mean, there's a lot of billionaire industrialists there, absolutely. A lot of gigantic wealth. But also, I think it's more important to point out that there's people like, you know, the head of the IMF and the president of the European Commission. There's people with genuine policy-making power there.
But why are they keeping this so secret? If they're going to be talking about things which could make a difference, why are they not coming out and saying, right, we're talking about this and we think we, as a whole, as an organisation, can make a big difference across the UK and across the world? Well, why are they being so secretive?
Well, you know what? That is the big question. That is the big question you've just asked. And I think what's emerging is that there isn't really any reason for them to be so secretive. And this year, for the first time, and this is historic, this has been going 59 years, for the first time, under pressure from journalists, they've actually hired a media communications company, and they put a little email address at the bottom of one of their statements. Unfortunately, they got scared, and a few hours later, they took it off again,
right,
from the website. So, but you know, these little acorns. You know, I feel like this little nervous creature has sort of nosed its way out into the air and is now ducking back again. But I think we can coax it out and have it behave normally, like any normal policy summit would behave.
But in real terms, between now and Saturday, you're going to be reporting on this. You're effectively reporting on nothing because you can't get into that room. You're not going to know what's going on, are you?
Well, I mean, you can, at the very least, you can infer from some of from the delegate list who is there, and they do release a sort of sketchy agenda. So you can put a few pieces together, and you can see that, for example, General Petraeus, the ex-head of the CIA, is there, and he's there with a few neocon friends, and he's working for Henry Travis, the head of KKR, a massive private equity fund, and you know that sort of smells a little bit of war in and a little bit of warmongery. So yeah. You know, there are little, you can make sort of inferences from just raw data, but also you know you can by turning up, and there's a lot of media turning up. Share information and, you know, just cover it as best you can. And by applying pressure, you know, you can make a difference and make this conference, you know, more transparent and more modern in a way.
A meeting of some of the world's most influential figures is taking place amid tight security in Hertfordshire today. It's the annual Bilderberg Conference, which sees politicians, industry leaders and high-ranking financial and academic officials gather over 3 days at the Grove Hotel near Watford. I still think it is in Watford, but there you go. Another argument for another day. It's a slight change, though, of a scene from last year when they met in the Seychelles. With hundreds of protesters expected to gather outside, local taxpayers are having to foot the bill, the police bill. Tony Gosling is a journalist who has been researching the Bilderberg conferences for the last 20 years. Tony, a very good morning to you.
Morning, Justin.
Thanks for joining us live across Beds, Hearts and Bucks. First of all, again, let me just put this question to you. A lot of people still asking, what is this conference? Can you tell us in layman's terms what this conference is actually about?
I certainly can, but I just want to correct you on one fact. Last year they actually met in the United States, not in the Seychelles. That was a joke actually put out by the Daily Telegraph a few days ago.
So our researchers have fallen for the joke. Is that what you're saying?
Right. right. And to be honest with you, to start with, I would say your churchgoers in your three counties should be crossing themselves today, because if you hadn't noticed, it's the 6th of the 6th. And if you add up all the numbers in 2013, there's another 6th there. but joking aside, I mean, this is a bit like all the Bond villains you've ever imagined getting together in the same place. And I'm afraid the news is that fascism is alive and well in the EU. I mean, the individuals at the moment, right across the European Union and also in the States, are actually being rewarded, as you might have noticed, for ruthlessness and greed, and particularly the bankers. There doesn't seem to be any proper check on what these bankers are up to. We've had all these different types of crises, with HSBC being involved in money laundering in the United States, and they're trying to extradite brokers and bankers over to the US to be prosecuted there. We've had Barclays and the LIBOR, the billions of pounds of mortgage payers' money being taken away from them. We've also have had the Payment Protection Insurance. They call it mis-selling. I would call it fraud. If you actually sell somebody something that isn't what you told them, it wouldn't do what you told them it was. It's a form of fraud. So that's what I think this is. It's a really a rather nasty collection of people who've made rather a lot of money out of us.
I want to play you something, because a lot of people are making comments about the protesters. I went down to the Grove last night and a few of them started arriving. This is one of the protesters. Now, just take a quick listen to this.
Global temperatures are rising, increasing all the time. The polar ice caps are melting. The sea levels are rising. The islands in the South Pacific are disappearing. The people are evacuating. Whole countries are going underwater. There are tornadoes, there's been hurricanes in America, West Nile disease, drought, there's famines, there's typhoons, there's cyclones.
And all the people inside the Grove are responsible for all of those things?
They control the capitalist system, which is destroying the planet, and humanity will be extinct by the end of the century.
I mean, come on, Tony. We've got somebody outside the Grove, and he's blaming the people inside that building for all the things that are going wrong on our lovely planet. Is that the calibre of protester that we can expect over the next 3 days?
Well, no, I mean, I think you can probably get better than people who are saying that the moon landing's never happened over the weekend. There's going to be some a lot better than that. But another thing I'd like to point out is that they certainly don't control the world, the Bilderbergs. They're very much focused on just the NATO countries. And this is no coincidence, because the whole thing started not long after the birth of NATO, after the Second World War in the 1950s. And one of the things that really irritates me, and we're very lucky actually to have this year, to have the list of participants and agenda, because normally they will only give the public that and the press that after they're all leaving in past years, many of the past years. So, you know, that one of the things they're discussing, as you may have noticed on there, is Africa's challenges. But they're not inviting a single African. In fact, no Africans are allowed to go to Bilderberg conferences.
How does that
work, then? Only the NATO countries.
So they're talking about Africa, but nobody from Africa's invited.
Well, it sounds a bit insulting and a bit like a throwback to the old bad old colonial days. I mean, one of the main movers and shakers there is Henry Kissinger. I mean, he is, anyone would who actually looked into him would describe as a war criminal. In 1969, he agreed and organised a secret bombing of Cambodia. He organised a military coup in Chile and in Indonesia. Also, he's one of the people behind the Turkish invasion of Cyprus. Now, a military coup is not a nice affair. What happens is that, for example, in Chile, is the democratic president was murdered, and Pinochet was installed, and then we had thousands and thousands after that of disappeared people. So, you know, a war criminal, very much like the sort of Bond villain I was talking about before. But then we've also got a rather toxic mix of our politicians going in too. The main ones being Ken Clark, George Osborne, Ed Balls and Mandelson. And hang on a minute, you know, I've pinched myself, Balls and Osborne, both in the same organisation. You know, maybe we're not really getting Labour Party economic policy or Conservative Party economic policy. We're getting Bilderberg economic policy.
That was me speaking on the mainstream media about the Bilderberg Fringe Festival, the Bilderberg conferences generally. And before me, it's a bit weird introducing yourself, but before me you heard Charlie Skelton. He's a journalist with The Guardian. He's also a comedy writer for Jimmy Carr, and he's been involved in a series called 10 O'Clock Live, one of the script editors for that. Now I'm joined by Jeff Sparks. You've been away for a couple of weeks, Jeff. You've been actually following the Romantic Poets.
Yes, I've been hooked on the Romantics again, visiting the last place where he lived, Grasmere, where Wordsworth lived.
Fantastic. So, well, you're not just a pretty face or a heavy metal shirt on. You're also into the Romantic Poets. What is it that attracts you about them?
I don't know. I guess it's just the way of life they had, and the way it was, the what they wrote was so epic in some cases, and they were very much influenced and inspired by nature as well.
Now, I'll tell you what, I had a chat to you earlier. It looks like over the next few weeks we might be hearing a little bit more about those Romantic Poets.
Oh, definitely will be.
Okay, Jeff, I look forward to those reports. But what's on this week?
Thank you. Starting with Friday, 28th of June, Crack and Oats will be performing at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £6 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 28th of June, The Orb will be performing at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £15 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Deep Purple. Over the next 12 months, there will be 10 new releases as part of the Deep Purple Overseas Live series. One of the first releases is Live in Copenhagen 1972, which features a lineup of Richie Blackmore, Ian Gillan, Roger Glover, John Lord and Ian Paice. This is a track from the album and it's titled Fireball. We'll be right back. Deep Purple with Fireball from the album Live in Copenhagen 1972. For more information, you can check out www.deeppurple.tv. On the Saturday 29th of June, G Baby I Love You will be performing with support from Funkensteins at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday 30th of June, Lizzie Dean will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is free and doors open at 8:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
That was Dialect. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. You can find us online at dialectradio.co.uk. We also go out on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at Friday, for every 2 p.m. every Friday. I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks for listening. Take care. Have a good week and join us next week.
Beauty of those in her eyes.